Thank you, Debbie. Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. I call to order a meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. Today is Wednesday, March 8th, 2017. And before we get started, I wanted to just acknowledge everyone who's wearing red. Today's International Day. What are we calling this? International Day for Women, Women's Day. And
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Some of us wear red every day.
We actually did not plan that. That was really, really good.
I'm just saying.
Yes, and so I know that you're very concerned about in support of women and their work. So just wanted to acknowledge today's a very important day. And we're going to get right down to business here. We're going to go out of order today from what's on the agenda due to a variety of reasons. We have different members of the legislature who need to be in different places. So we're going to change the order up here a little bit. We'll start with the work session on Senate Bill 298, and then we're going to hear Senate Bill 398, Senate Bill 779, Senate Bill 294, and Senate Bill 780. So that's the order. And I'm going to go ahead and start the work session on Senate Bill 298, or opening the work session on Senate Bill 298. Deborah, will you please summarize the bill?
Yes. So you heard this bill on February 20th, 2017. It came at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. It grants the Labor Commissioner discretion in matters over preparation and pursuit of formal charges in certain situations, declares an emergency, and effective on passage. It has a subsequent referral to the Senate Committee on Judiciary. It has no amendments. It has no revenue impact. And it has a fiscal light for purposes of transmitting the measure to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay. So there are no amendments. You clarified that. There is a subsequent referral to the Senate Judiciary. Fiscal impact statement, we have that, and the revenue impact statement, there's no impact. And so I'm going to go ahead and ask for a motion.
Chair Taylor, I move that Senate Bill 298 be moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Senate Committee on Judiciary by prior reference.
Okay. Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 298 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Senate Committee on Judiciary by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call. We'll have a roll call. Roll call, I guess.
Senator
Gelser? Absent. Excused.
Senator Hansel?
Excused.
Senator Mons Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Knope?
Aye.
Aye. Majority of votes required for passage. We have those. And the motion passes. And I'm going to ask for Senate Bill 298. Senator Manas Anderson, would you be willing?
Okay.
Oh, no, we're just going to bring it over to Judiciary. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 298 and open a public hearing. Close the work session, sorry, on 298. And we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 398. And ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
This bill is sponsored by Senator Steiner Hayward and Representative Kenny Geyer. It requires employers to include notice in the employee pay stubs that a recipient may be entitled to an earned income tax credit under federal tax laws and to provide an internet address and telephone number for further information. It requires the Department of Revenue, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Employment Department to adopt rules to increase employee awareness of the earned income tax credit. It requires employers to post summaries of the administrative rules, and it requires BOLI to make summaries of the rules and, upon request, the complete text of the rules available to employers without charge. There are no amendments to this bill.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and call up Senator Steiner Hayward, please, Jessica Daly, and Beverly Stein. And then on deck, we are going to have Philip Kennedy Wong, Matt Newell, and John Mullen, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner here with State Senate District 17. And I very much appreciate your hearing Senate Bill 398, which will increase awareness of and hopefully utilization of the Earned Income Tax Credit. For background information, the Earned Income Tax Credit is a federal tax benefit for working people with low to moderate income. And according to the IRS and to anti-poverty groups that you'll be hearing more about from my colleagues, the EITC is one of the largest anti-poverty programs. It's enough extra income that it gets a lot of people above the poverty threshold and to the place where they don't need as many supplemental social service programs. But a lot of people don't use it. The use rate for the people who are eligible in Oregon, it's estimated that only 74% of them actually receive the earned income tax credit. And largely that's due to several factors. First is a lack of awareness for the earned income tax credit and that it's even there. Second is the fact that you actually have to file federal taxes, even if you would not have to file for other reasons because of your income. And that requires a certain amount of paperwork. And it can't just be a 1040 EZ. You have to actually file an itemized 1040. And the families who are eligible for this are often juggling multiple jobs and multiple other responsibilities and small children. And they are the ones who have the least amount of discretionary time and resources to figure out what they need. But, in fact, there are a lot of great resources available even online that can help people navigate through this. And we believe that just by giving people information about the earned income tax credit, they will be much more likely to take advantage of it. We want them to take the responsibility for doing the work. We're not going to do it for them. But without the information that it even exists or how to access the information about how to get to the place that can help them, it's very hard for people to take advantage of this. To give you a sense of how much this is, for the 2016 tax year, people who might be eligible, if you have if you're a single person with one qualifying child, you probably qualify for the EITC with an income of less than $39,000 a year. For two qualifying children, it's less than almost $45,000 a year. So as you can see, even if you're earning above minimum wage, you're going to be well above minimum wage, you're going to be eligible for the EITC for quite some time. And that extra $2,000 can make a huge difference to a family like this. It can be the difference when we're dealing with housing crisis to be able to stay in your home. It can be not having to choose between food and medication. There are a whole host of things that can benefit people with this money. And it's federal money we're leaving on the table. It's just there. And we should be bringing it back to help Oregonians. So what Senate Bill 398 does, and actually there will be what turns out to be a Dash 2 amendment, but you haven't seen it yet. We just got it back. It's not through pubs yet. That changes it to make it simpler for employers, because initially we were going to require that the information be on the pay stub. But a lot of people get direct deposit now, and their pay stubs are different, and there's already a lot of requirements about what has to go on pay stubs. So they're getting crowded, and it requires software reprogramming for employers, and that seems like an unreasonable burden. But it is not an unreasonable burden to require that they put information in when they give people their W-2s every year. Once a year, right when people are thinking about taxes, you give them the information. You say, you've earned this money. Here's a place where you can calculate whether you are, in fact, eligible, and it will give you information about how to claim this money and how to navigate filing your taxes. In addition, it would be required to be added to the minimum wage required posting that's required by BOLI and by state law. And we think that's the most appropriate way to do it so that people don't have to put up yet another poster that just gets added to an existing one. There's already space on that poster, according to the Bureau of Labor and Industry. And it's the most relevant one because it's the people who are earning minimum wage who are most likely to be eligible for the earned income tax credit. So we think that giving people information in these two specific areas, in these two specific ways that are pretty minimal burden on employers, and take advantage of existing postings that have to get renewed every year, because minimum wage is, as we know, changing on an annual basis now, means that it's a relatively low burden on anybody, and it gives people information so that they can claim a benefit that they've earned and give them a little bit more margin to help families that are on the poverty line. My colleagues will talk about this in much more detail and talk about the importance of EITC as an anti-poverty program, but I wanted to lay the structure for the bill and give you the opportunity to ask me any questions before I go off to my other committee.
Okay. Does anyone want to ask questions of Senator Steiner Hayward before she has to leave? Okay. And if you're welcome to stay, or if
I just go. I wish I could, Madam Chair, because I know my colleagues are going to give me useful information on top of what they already have, but unfortunately, my committee chair will be grumpy if I don't.
So. Well, I do have one question.
yes, ma'am.
Madam Chair, thank you. Will there be tracking us to see what impact this actually does if it does pass?
Chair Taylor, Senator Mona Sanderson, that's a great question. We will know, actually, by finding out how many people file federal, who are in these income brackets. We know how many people file federal income tax returns, and we will be able to see where there's an increase in filing and whether we get those, they're getting those claims back. So we will have the ability to track it. The bill itself does not include a requirement for tracking. We could, but I don't want to impose an unnecessary burden. But we'll have that information available to us through the Department of Revenue.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, hello, Ms. Stein. How are you?
I am fine, thank you.
Nice to see you.
Thank you very much. Chair Taylor and members of the committee, it's a delight to be here on behalf of the Oregon Business Council. I work at Portland State. I'm a senior fellow at Portland State, and one of my jobs is to staff the Oregon Business Council Poverty Task Force. The Poverty Task Force has adopted a comprehensive strategy that's evidence-based to address the issues of poverty from the aspects of the community, the family. Yes, I'm sorry.
Can you state your name for the record,
I'm sorry,
please?
Beverly Stein. I thought I did. I haven't been here in a long time, obviously. We focused on community, family, work, and education. And one of the components of the strategies that we've developed is really emphasizing the earned income tax credit. As Senator Steiner Hayward mentioned, it's a really important component of addressing poverty because it puts money in people's pockets who need the money, who then can use it to support their families, to address issues of their car that's not working or whatever. In my official testimony, which I'm not going to read to you, there's some really great information about the impact on children and on families of having to just that little bit of more money in their pockets. The EITC is an important component, but it is not being used significantly by people in Oregon. We are second from the last. We used to be last. We're now second from the last of all states in terms of those who are eligible for the EITC taking advantage of it. So there are other states that are doing better than we are in this arena, and there are a variety of ways that we can address this, but one of them is to address the notification issue, because as we've researched this, what we've found is that one of the key reasons why people are not taking advantage of it, they don't know that they are eligible for it, and even more, that they don't know that it's refundable so that they have to file their taxes to get it. So many low-income people who aren't filing their taxes because they don't think they made enough money could get the EITC if they in fact filed their taxes. So this is just one way, and an important way, for people who are eligible for this important resource to take advantage of it. So we urge the passage of this bill with the amendments as it proceeds through the process here. So thank you very much for your time, and I urge you to support. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name is Jess Daly. I'd like to thank the chair for having us, and we'd also like to thank Senator Hayward for inviting us today. I work for the Oregon Business Council's Poverty Task Force. Today I've been asked to speak on behalf of the task force chair, Dave Underreiner. He is the chief executive for Providence Health and Services of Oregon. We're pleased to come before the committee today to advocate for this bill. It's a simple bill, and it really does have the potential to help thousands of Oregonians. The EITC is the largest self-sufficiency program we have in the U.S. In 2013, 300,000 Oregonians benefited from the credit, and it brought over $580 million into our state. Unfortunately, we're leaving about $130 million on the table. And if we look at information from the Brookings Institute, that they did some research in the city of San Antonio, and for every dollar from the EITC that's brought into the community, it creates $1.58 in local economic activity. Studies at the National Bureau of Economics and the Economic Policy Institute have both shown the EITC to lift over half the children whose families received the credit out of poverty. Oregon has yet to return to pre-recession poverty rates. The legislation is especially important in a state where over 600,000 people are living below the poverty line, including one in five children. The child care credit combined with the EITC lifted an estimated 65,000 of Oregon's children above the poverty line from 2011 to 2013. The uncertainty of federal funding for state programs increases the urgency to capture all of the federal dollars we possibly can. Oregon is ranked near the bottom of EITC utilization for a number of years. The Business Council's Poverty Tax Force has worked in the past to increase utilization of the credit by working with local utility providers and service providers, nonprofits like Cash Oregon. We believe that there is the underclaiming of the credit is a result of a variety of issues, including awareness, the rural urban divide, language barriers, and education of the credit. This little bill greatly simplifies the complex process of education and awareness that needs to take place statewide. This bill has the potential to help thousands of Oregonians, and we're happy to show strong support for it. We thank you for your time today.
Okay, great. Does anybody have any questions? Yes, Senator Knope.
I may have missed it, but do either of you know that if everybody claimed the credit who is eligible, what kind of revenue that would bring into the state of Oregon?
If the additional people who are eligible would be about $130 million.
And if you look at that, for every dollar that comes into the state, we're getting 1.5 back. That's even more. So.
And I think it would particularly impact communities where there are people who are lower income, that more money is going to go to those. So it could be rural communities.
In general, in Oregon, there's a 25% reduction for poverty for children whose families receive the credit. And that's it goes up for children of color to 30%. 30% reduction.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to call up Philip Kennedy Wong, Matt Newall, and John Mullen, please. Hello, gentlemen. I apologize. We seem to be having a trend here in the Senate Workforce Committee of that we have all these bills before us and so many people who want to testify on other bills as well. So I'm going to have to ask each of you to keep your testimony to about 2 minutes, please, if it's possible.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, Philip Kennedy Wong. I am here to represent Oregon Food Bank, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 398. So I will be brief, given your request, and my message really isn't something that you haven't heard before. I think many of you understand that. In fact, as I'm looking at every member of this committee, I think all of you have visited a food bank facility in your legislative district. So you recognize that it takes a lot of tools to fight hunger, and for us, the Earned Income Tax Credit is an incredible tool. $130 million is a lot of money to be leaving on a table for low-income families that are struggling to earn every dollar that they need to survive. And for us, we serve, obviously, people who are working and aren't earning enough. And some of you know, based on the recent revenue forecast, you know, job growth is still continuing in Oregon, which is great. But unfortunately, from a food bank, food distribution standpoint, we are still distributing at a recession level, and that's approximately 90 million pounds of food statewide, which is a lot of food, which tells us that, you know, there's more to be done to fight hunger and to end poverty. So that is my testimony. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello. Good afternoon. For the record, Matt Newell Ching with Partners for Hunger Free Oregon. I'll be brief as well. You know, we work primarily on issues relating to you know, hunger and nutrition. And, you know, the families that we talk to that access their income tax credit, the EITC is game-changing for families. You know, I talked to one gentleman who, you know, he has three kids, and he used his earned income tax credit 1 year to purchase a small minivan so that he could get his kids around to drop off at school and to get to work more reliably. It saved hours off of his daily, you know, commute. That freed up time for his kids to do out-of-time school activities and to pursue his own job. For others, it can mean first or last month's deposit on rent. It can mean classes to secure a higher-paying job. It can reduce toxic stress in a household. And as others have mentioned, Oregon has the third lowest rate of participation in the Earned Income Tax Credit of any state in the nation. That's something that we can do about. We believe that this the Senate Bill 398 is an important tool in the toolbox. I know there are some other conversations in other parts of the building and in other state agencies. For example, at DHS, they're looking at ways that they can better inform clients who are on SNAP of the Earned Income Tax Credit. And in the WIC department, they're looking at ways that they can inform clients as well. So I think there are many ways that we can improve communication about eligibility to folks, and I think this is one of them. It's a good bill, and we urge passage. Thank you.
Okay, great. Mr. Mullen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I just want to make a couple of very brief comments and just to point out the fact that Oregon Law Center Human Services Coalition were very much involved in the creation of the state earned income tax credit. So when we look at the need for outreach, we'll also benefit people that are claiming the state credit. The program itself, of course, has a lot of value and worth, as Matt has pointed out, but unless people know about it and participate, the effect is there is no effect at all. Back in 2016, a number of us worked to have a more comprehensive bill involving the Department of Human Services doing more methods of outreach to secure greater participation. Was felt it wasn't the right time to do that right now. It's a session that there's a struggle for looking for dollars, and so this very low-cost solution to help with outreach and participation is something that we really very much support. In the mix of things, we think we'll probably be talking about earned income tax credit and other discussions towards the end of the session as revenue issues get discussed. But for now, the idea of getting greater participation for the people that need this program is really a great thing. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. We're going to go ahead and close public hearing on Senate Bill 398, and we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 779. And I ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
SB 779 is sponsored by the Committee on Business and Transportation. It specifies that for purposes of determining whether an employer is required to implement sick time policy allowing employees to use paid sick time, the number of employees working for the employer does not include the director of the corporation who has a substantial ownership interest, member of a limited liability company, or partner of limited liability partnership, nor does it include parent, spouse, or child of such individuals. There are no amendments at this time.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and we're going to try to, believe it or not, I think we have an even number of folks who are here for the proponents and opponents, which is very nice. So we're going to trade this off here. We'll start with Anthony Smith, Molly McCarger, and John Iverson, please. And let's see. Yeah, we'll start with those three. Mm-hmm. Who wants to start?
I'll start.
Okay.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, Anthony Smith with the National Federation of Independent Business. NFIB represents nearly 7,000 small businesses here in Oregon, many being the smallest of small businesses. I think on a later panel, you will have Jenny Dressler from the Farm Bureau come up and give a more in-depth analysis than what my comments are going to be limited to. So I'll just go ahead and get into that. We do urge you to support SB 779, which clarifies that business owners and their family members are exempt from the employee count for the purposes of paid sick time. Please keep in mind that NFIB represents small businesses in every industry of Oregon's private sector, with 70% of our members having fewer than 10 employees. But that depends on how we count them versus how the state counts them. Most small businesses would never count their owners as employees, and many of them would also exclude their immediate family members from being considered employees. They're just part of the family business. Those small business families utilize varying business structures for tax purposes, and regardless of how the business is organized, the owners of the business are likely to have family members like parents, spouse, children who are actively involved in that family business. 2015's Senate Bill 454 did not intend to treat one business entity different than another based solely on the organizational status of that business. Similarly, the paid sick time law did not intend that business owners should have to count themselves when calculating the number of employees employed by that employer. And Senate Bill 779 clarifies that a business owner would not be counted as an employee regardless of whether that person is on the payroll. It just doesn't make sense for family businesses to have to pay themselves sick time. And clearly the intent behind the employee count threshold of Senate Bill 454 was to draw a distinction between the requirements imposed on large businesses versus small businesses with respect to paid and unpaid sick time. We encourage you to support the bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Molly McCarger. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 779. I'm a fourth-generation farmer at Peermine Farms here in Jervis, Oregon, just a few minutes north here of Salem. Like most farming operations in Oregon, we're a family business. We're an S-Corp, and I receive a salary as well as my father and brother, and so therefore we receive a W-2 every year. We currently farm about 1,000 acres, and of those 1,000 acres, we have about five crops that are very labor-intensive. And each year those crop acres vary, which varies the need for our labor. So our numbers can go up and down and fluctuate with the 10 employees per day in a 20-week period. And so with that, in 2015, when the sick leave law was passed, originally passed, the law exempted parents, spouses, and children of business owners in that employee sick count. And I believe that it was intended to help reduce any additional financial burden or tracking burdens that small businesses like ours, particularly farmers and ranchers, would face. And we appreciate the law acknowledging that agriculture, the industry is very unique, to say the least. And unfortunately, it appears that the recent interpretations of the law have reversed this exemption, creating confusion as well as possibly unintentional noncompliance. Many of us in small businesses, especially farmers, we wear many hats. We're the HR, we're the tractor drivers, we're the mechanics, we're the bookkeepers. Occasionally, I try to do laundry and feed my family, maybe not as well at those two things. And so when we're trying to keep up with these interpretations of these laws, it can be very challenging. And I don't want to play and pretend to be a lawyer, so I'd like to keep that one off of there. But our biggest farms are challenged with our farm with the sick leave law is identifying whether we're exempt or not. If you count my brother and my father and I, there is five of us full-time year-round. If you don't, there's two. So with the seasonal increases in the summertime, you know, our numbers vary from 10 to 60, depending on the crop and the time of year. But if you take the three of us off, I went back and looked at 3 years' worth of our payroll history, and in 2014, based on the current interpretation of the law, we didn't qualify to pay sick leave, just barely. Current interpretation, looking at the 2015 payroll history, we are over by 2 weeks. If you look at 2016's history, we're back under the threshold of exemption by 4 weeks. So not only does it pose a frustration with tracking and time-consuming of tracking all of this and whether or not we're in compliance with the law, it's also, I think the unintentional side effect of this is the frustration and confusion for our employees. Our employees won't know year to year whether or not they're going to be able to be paid sick leave or not. And so I think that there's some, and I don't think that was the intention of this. Senate Bill 779 provides much needed fix, clarifying that business owners and family members are not counted in the employee sick leave time. And by removing us, our farm will be well far under the 10 employees 20-week threshold exemption and eliminate frustration and confusion for not only us but our employees. As a family farmer, I can tell you that Senate Bill 779 is necessary to help small businesses effectively implement the sick time law. I ask for your support to reduce confusion and burden for family farmers like myself and help facilitate compliance of this law. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. Okay, thank you.
Senator Taylor, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak today. John Iverson, Iverson Family Farms. We farm outside of Woodburn. Like Molly, a true family farm. My grandpa started the farm in 1950, had six kids. Originally five of them came back to the farm. 15 years ago, two left the farm. So I farm if you count families, full-time employees, we have seven, but that would include my dad, my aunt, my uncle, as me as well. So we have three non-family full-time members, which have been with the farm for over 25 years. All of them get paid sick leave. We take care of them very well. But we're like Molly, we're in that flux of busy time. We're hiring on extra people. And a lot of times those are cousins or different high schoolers. And so they work for 3 months during the summertime between school. And so like Molly, we're current with the original interpretation of the rule, we were under the exemption of not having to pay sick time to those employees. But you start counting family members, and we quickly jump over that threshold as well. And so, again, I'm paying my cousin sick leave at that point for driving combine for 3 months, you know, 16-year-old. It doesn't make sense with that for our family. Like, our full-time employees, we're already taking care of those people. But for family members that are working 3 months of the year, it makes it kind of silly. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Does anybody have any questions? All right. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Up, and we're going to call up opponents of the bill, Kate Newall, Ramon Ramirez, and Matt Swanson, please. And then after that, we'll bring up Jenny Dressler, Terry Cowhart, and Jim Geisinger. Okay, so let me just confirm here. Is Ramon, do you happen to know if he's here today?
He is here, and I'm surprised he's not in the room.
Okay, well, maybe he'll come. Okay, well, maybe he'll come. You guys can go ahead and start.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, here today representing Family Forward Oregon. We are here today in opposition to Senate Bill 779, which would roll back sick time protections and eliminate sick time protections for certain workers, as you've just heard. Family Forward worked hard, along with many others, in 2015 to pass a very strong and inclusive paid sick time law in Oregon. This law is meant to ensure that all workers are able to take time off when they or a family member are ill. We see it as an important public health measure and a basic right to which all workers should be entitled to. We are opposed to any changes to the new law, like Senate Bill 779, that would roll back or eliminate sick time protections for any worker in Oregon. From our perspective, if even a single worker loses access to paid sick time, we see that as too many. While Senate Bill 779 might be characterized as a simple technical fix, we respectfully disagree. We see it as a substantive policy shift that has the net impact of taking paid sick time away from workers who are currently eligible for and receive paid sick time under the law. I think you've heard a little bit about what the bill does, so I'll skip that part of my testimony. But really what this is about is who counts in the overall number of employee count. And that's important because that determines if paid or unpaid sick time is due to those employees. So for everywhere outside the city of Portland, if you have more than 10 employees, you're required to offer paid sick time. And fewer than 10 employees, you're required to offer unpaid sick time. So as you just heard, current law does exempt the parents, spouses, and children of business owners from the definition of employee. And those family members are exempt from both sick time protections and the overall employee count. We think that Boley's interpretation of this provision as only applying to sole proprietorships is correct and appropriate. Only an individual can have parents, spouses, or children. LLCs are a legal entity that can't actually have any parents, spouses, or children. We think that Boley would have been outside of their statutory authority to define this any other way. We think the statute is clear, and LLCs and LLPs should not be included. Regardless, our coalition never supported the exemption from sick time for parents, spouses, and children of business owners. We agreed to the compromise that was advocated for by the business lobby, but we didn't then, and we don't now, see family members as any less deserving of paid sick time than other workers. And we certainly don't support excluding a wider universe of family members from the overall employee count. We do see Senate Bill 779 as a real threat that could mean a loss of paid sick time for workers. Let's just use an example. So say an LLC has 15 employees total, and they've got six employees that are spouses, children, or parents of LLC members. What that means, if this bill were to pass, is that there's going to be nine employees who currently get sick time today who are not going to have it anymore, who would lose access. And that's why we see this as much, much more than just a technical fix to the paid sick time law. I would also just raise another concern that we have, and we think that this passage of this bill would create a loophole that could very, very easily be abused. There's nothing in this bill that would preclude an LLC from making its employees LLC partners with a very, very small, let's say, 1/1,000,000th share ownership in the LLC. What that would mean then is then that individual and their parent, spouse, and children would all be exempted from the overall count of how many employees that employer has. Because of that possibility, we see this as much, much more dangerous than just simply sort of the concerns that I had described before. We think this is a dangerous precedent to set and could be a target for abuse. And in addition to all of this, we see this legislation as unfairly targeting agricultural workers, who appear to be the class of workers who would most be impacted by this bill. We see this as very discriminatory and damaging to some of the state's most vulnerable workers and a group of workers who most need access to paid sick time. And in closing, I will just say, given the very real threats to the basic health and well-being of our communities at the national level and to workers, we should be working here to protect and expand the basic rights that we have just achieved here in Oregon, not rolling them back. And for this reason, we urge your no vote on Senate Bill 779. Thank you.
Okay. Do you want to ask a question?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the testimony. And I want to start out with I agree. I don't think that anybody is less deserving of sick time than others. And I appreciate that you hadn't agreed to the compromise or the idea for it. I did, and we voted for it when we worked on it in the committee. And what I'm trying to understand as I went back through the process, mm-hmm. I understood what this bill proposes to do to be what we did. So when this issue came up with Boley last fall, I was really surprised, and it made sense, the idea that the LLC itself is not a person and an LLC cannot have a child, but we didn't discuss that in the committee, and I think many of us left that process with the belief that when we were going to talk with business owners in our community, small restaurants, farms that were predominantly family, that they were excluded on the basis of that. I know it was in my written material. So I find myself in a difficult place where how this is written is what I thought I already voted for a while back. And I appreciate the challenge of losing something that has been gained, but I wonder if any thought has been given to, could we do something that corrects this moving forward, protecting the leave that people have now, and are there ways to tighten up that piece around the LLC, just because I think for those of us that voted for it and worked on that negotiation, it's something that I agreed to before, and I try to keep my commitments.
So thank you, Chair Taylor, Senator Gelser. I guess what I would say in response to that is I think it, as I remember back to that time and thinking about this provision, I was always thinking of a business owner as a business owner, one person. I wasn't thinking of it as a broader universe of people that might be, you know, I am not an expert in LLC law, but I think they can have up to 35 LLC partners. I certainly was never thinking of that when I was, when we were agreeing to, and yes, we agreed to it too. But again, I would just come back to, I was always thinking in my mind of one business owner and that one business owner's parents, spouse, and children, not potentially a universe of 35 owners.
And I would agree. I wasn't thinking of a universe of 35 owners, but and I would agree that would be something to clarify and strengthen. But on that other piece, what am I missing? And I don't think I was the only legislator that I've had conversations with that supported the bill that understood that how this bill is written is what the...
So, Chair Taylor, Senator Gelser, I would be more than happy to have that conversation with the proponents of this bill. I guess I would still just come back to a place of, in my mind, if any single worker that currently has sick time protections is losing them, I think that's something that's very concerning to me. And I certainly wasn't, when we were talking about that back in 2015, thinking about anything more than just one business owner.
And again, I think we're similar on that part, but I was not thinking about that being limited by the corporation status of the organization. So there could be a single family that is that LLC, and that wouldn't necessarily be 23, 23 people. I think that piece of it was, I would be surprised. I would also be surprised and concerned if somebody came back and said, we have 100 employees and we still fall out under the threshold because everybody is a parent. I mean, clearly that would be an abuse and not what we talked about. On the other hand, a family that has 9 family members that are working and 2 additional employees, and they were organized as an LLC, that is what I understood that we were doing before. So I'm trying to get into that piece. And again, I understand the part about we don't want to take things away from people that have it. Is there a way to go and protect people that have it now and comply with the agreement that we made to pass the bill?
And Senator Taylor, Senator Gelser, I would be more than happy to have those conversations. This bill certainly doesn't do that and is much wider than what we've just talked about.
Thank you.
Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Chair. I agree with Senator Gelser 100%. I think Boley has interpreted, which was not legislative intent. I'm a farm boy. I don't know of any farm anywhere in the state, family-owned farm, that just the patriarch owns it all. For tax purposes, for estate planning, for successive moving, the inheritance, they all have particular organizational structures. That's the way farming is, and that's when this was passed. Never in my wildest dreams would I ever anticipate Boley would completely, in my opinion, do an interpretation which wasn't legislative intent at all. I'm with Sarah Gelser. We voted on this, and I thought that what we were voting on was what's in 779. So both a statement and agreement with my colleague.
Senator Monson-Anderson.
Well, I'll just join the bandwagon. My family, the Grainings, their farms are in Kansas, but it's the very same thing. There are huge farms, multiple family ownership on the farms, and I thought they would have been protected, or not protected, but the 779 interpreted them as being part of the family.
Okay, maybe we should have some clarification. Who is the LC? Does anybody know on this bill? Who is the LC on this? Who drafted this? Do we know? Because, well, I mean, obviously we're not moving the bill today, but I think we need to have the drafter come.
If I may, Chair Taylor and members of the committee, I do think you have in OLIS a response from Boley about sort of where they thought their, and Boley is here too, about where they thought their statutory authority was. And I guess, I agree with Boley in looking at it. However, the legislature wants to sort of take up and look at it. I do believe that Boley was right in not being able to extend, when we said business owner, to that beyond just the business owner, which would be a sole proprietorship, because again, the LLCs aren't a person, they're a legal entity. So an LLC can't have parent, spouse, or child.
Okay, so thank you for that. And I realize that it seems like we have two dynamics going on here. And I appreciate that we have to work within the legal framework, and we have this definition of what an LLC is. And we obviously have a definition I assume there's a definition of a family in this for the original sick leave bill. It seems that we're having obviously a problem, because could there be a situation, let's just kind of step back a little bit, could there be a situation where there is a family farm, meaning a parent, children, working on the farm, that is simultaneous, that is a LLC? Could it be that in just one family, just the Taylor family, my husband and I and my children, we are an LLC, but we are family farm? Do you see what I'm saying? That it could be two things at once. Is that possible?
Well, Chair Taylor, I do think that could be possible, and I guess that's exactly what my concern with this bill is that it would be extending to all of the parent, spouse, and child of any of the LLC members. So I think when we talked about the bill in 2015, we were thinking of one business owner, one family type situation. And I guess that's
part of my concern is just how much more this adds to that.
Okay, so let's say, so I happen to have three brothers. I don't come from a farming family, but I have three brothers. So let's say the Taylor Farm is owned by myself and my three brothers and my nieces and nephews, and we all worked on the farm, and we are one LLC. In your view, are you saying that you don't think that this should apply to my brothers and to their, the sick leave exception should not apply to my brothers and their, and my nieces and nephews? Or you just think it should apply to my husband and my, me and my children?
Well, let me, Chair Taylor, let me back up just a second. So the current law exemption for family members of a business owner, it's only the parent, spouse, and child of the individual business owner. So I think that the scenario that you described, I think is closer in keeping with what that intent was back in 2015, which is to have it be, yes, one family. I think what I'm expressing is as a concern that this legislation could go so much farther than that.
Okay, so it sounds like I hear that you're wanting it not to be one of my brother's best friends, and then they're one non-family member's added into it, and then it be somehow extended to them if we're not careful with the definition. So is there something that could happen? I'm wondering if there's some way to address the definition issue in this so that if the intent, which I don't know because I wasn't on the committee, even though I did vote for the bill, if the intent was for the family farm sick leave exception, that it would be to address what some people are bringing up.
Madam Chair, can I add to the question?
Yes.
So maybe if there was an amendment to the bill that described, you know, that the LLC would be covered, but the members of the LLC could only be first-degree relatives of one another. So it's the brother, not the best friend. You really are keeping within that.
But I don't know if it's a good idea or not. I'm just
asking. Well, I guess what I would say is I would be more than
being the devil's advocate of whether or not
for that. I would rather be exploring that with a little bit more thought put into it than sort of thinking about it off the cuff right here. And I think the concern that I really have is that the way that this is drafted, that we're not just talking about Senator Taylor's family, you could also be making all of your employees partners of your LLC with such a minuscule share, and then suddenly all of your current employees that you have made a tiny, tiny partner are also exempt, as are their parents, spouse, and children.
Okay. So, Ms. Newell, just so you know, the reason I brought up the example, I intentionally brought it up in the committee format just so that folks can really flesh out and hear what your concern is. You're not trying to, as I hear you're saying, you're not necessarily trying to say family farms focusing that they not be allowed the privileges they've already been granted, but that you're just concerned about it spreading and it being abused outside of the definition. And so we have this hiccup, and we need to get to
And if I may, I would just say my biggest concern, and it always is, I sort of started my testimony with this, I'm generally opposed to anything that means any worker who currently has access to paid protected sick time loses it. I think that's a step backwards for Oregon.
Okay. So maybe we'll have, I'm sorry, gentlemen, we're just going to have you step back for 1 minute and have Boley come up just because in the middle of this and clarify any questions. Thank you for staying up here, Ms. Newell.
Yeah, okay.
So Paloma, can you just clarify how it works now, just so all of us are on the same page, we all have the same information? People who are watching, people in the audience, how it works now, what the interpretation is by Boley, et cetera. So.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. So there's a couple things going on. One, this bill creates sort of some new language that's around excluding employees, certain types of employees from the count. The original bill is passed. Excluded from the definition of employee, an individual employed by that individual's parent, spouse, or child.
Okay, so that's there now.
So those are two different elements that are happening. That language is identical to existing language that's in other statutes enforced by Boley that we have enforced over the years. There was a lot of discussion about what would we go into Senate Bill 454 before it was passed in 2015. There wasn't a lot of discussion on the record. So in context with the plain language, one, the plain language defined an employee as anybody who gets a paycheck, and then had exemptions that defined who is not an employee as an individual employed by that individual's parent, spouse, or child. A corporation isn't an individual. They can't have a parent, spouse, or child. The same with LLCs. And consistent with existing language that we have enforced for years, we have always said that that only applied to a sole proprietorship. So identical language that's in other statutes.
Okay.
So that's how we got where we are to our interpretation that this existing exclusion only applies to a sole proprietorship.
Okay. Thank you very much for clarifying mm-hmm. that. Does anybody have any questions for Paloma since we have her up here? Okay. Did you want to add anything, Ms. Newhall, before? Okay. All right. Let's go ahead and bring back up Mr. Swanson and Mr. Ramirez. Who wants to start? You were on time here, so we'll go with you.
Yeah.
Bird
gets the worm.
That's right.
So I do think, rather than rehash, I think some of the things that Kate said, you know, for us, this was the over 60,000 members of this. Oh, for the record, Matt Swanson, Service Employees International Union. I am here to speak in opposition of Senate Bill 779 as written. I think for us, it really comes down to couple of things. You know, one, when this was passed, it was really something for us that was made economic sense and also moral sense for workers that have received paid sick time. This has been really a godsend. I can think of some of our members who, for the very first time, have been able to deal with some illnesses or illnesses in their family and not have to deal with the crushing weight of kind of the economics of missing a day off. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal. What we're concerned about with this, and I think Kate articulated it well, and I think we can, you know, definitely continue to talk with proponents of the bill, is that some of the language changes could, you know, our concern is that that's going to take away sick days from those who currently are getting them. It sounds like there's some, you know, the folks are, I think, in good faith trying to address some confusion around that, but, you know, our impression here is that we don't want to take away something that folks are currently having. The other piece is, are we opening up a loophole, perhaps unintended loophole on behalf of proponents, but something that could allow folks to drive a larger exemption. So we, you know, we were not involved in the creation of this legislation, but in our view, it's important that we don't create a larger loophole or something that could allow folks out from under providing paid sick leave. So I think that's the goal here. Certainly willing to be engaged in that conversation, but we definitely do not want to see us go backwards from that important benefit that many workers now have for the first time in their lives. And I think it's been a beautiful thing to watch as people really have access to that type of leave. But understandably, this law is only a year old. So I do think that, you know, things will play out. I'd love to see some more data on the number of businesses we are talking about. I think, yes, working this overtime could be helpful, but I know there's folks here who probably drove and aren't here every day, would love to come talk about it. So thank you very much.
Mr. Ramirez.
Thank you. For the record, Senator Taylor and members of the committee, my name is Ramon Ramirez. I'm president of the Oregon Farm Worker Union, PICUM, and we were active participants in the formation of the paid sick leave legislation. We were one of the organizations pushing for this because we felt like for farm workers who don't have very many rights, this was one thing that was, for me personally, was a major victory. You know, I witnessed a farm, for example, here in the Willamette Valley, about 15 miles from here, that one of the workers there, and this was a few years ago, got sick. They lived in a barn with chickens. And so he asked the employer and the crew boss, hey, I have a fever, take me to the doctor. And he was denied that. 3 days later, he contaminated a crew of 21 workers with typhoid fever, the first documented case of typhoid fever in 75 years, right? That crop, it was a strawberry crop, had to be destroyed, and those workers had to be quarantined at the state hospital not too far away from here until they were cleared. That is an example of why we need paid sick leave. And so for us, it's really important. We have concerns with Senate Bill 779 because we believe that we fought pretty extensively to include farm workers. Mm-hmm. I know the ag industry came in and they wanted an exemption. And I think with the leadership of with this legislature, we were able to get farm workers included. And we don't want to see anything taking any of those workers not covered, right? Because of the extension of coverage of families, right, in LLCs. Now I gotta say that currently there is before coming to testify, I did an analysis of about five farms within about 20-mile radius here, and a lot of the farms are now including in the LLCs farm workers that have been with the company a number of years. For example, on one farm, one of the biggest farms here, they've included not only their farm labor contractor to be part of their company, but also high-level management. So if we were to include those folks right under this definition, then we fear that more farm workers will be excluded from coverage. And along with my colleagues, I think that I'd be willing to sit down and come to the table with a farm worker agricultural perspective on this and work with other people in the committee and others that are promoting this legislation to come up with a reasonable solution. Okay. But currently the way it's written, we have some serious concerns about it.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions?
I would make a comment. Yes. Charlie Cheek was the person who drafted Senate Bill 454 in 2015, and Gail Stevens is the one that did this one.
Yeah, thank you for that. I really appreciate that. Thank you, and I appreciate, Mr. Ramirez, you making that generous offer to talk with others. I always like that when someone's willing to have a conversation, so I appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, so we're going to go ahead and call up Jenny Dressler, Terry Cowart, and Jim Geisinger, please. And then after that, we'll have Emily McLean and Iris Hodge, please. Hello. We have some other bills we're hearing today as well, so we're going to need to be a little time sensitive, please. So, okay, who would like to start?
I can kick off. Thank you. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We are the state's largest general ag association, representing about 7,000 farming and ranching families across the state. Today we are here to support Senate Bill 779, and we do see it as a technical fix clarifying what we believe passed in the 2015 session. You have my testimony in front of you, and it references several places of legislative intent that were referenced with regard to employee count and whether or not family members would be included in that. I do want to just confirm for the record that whether or not a business is actually counted at 10 employees, those workers are still guaranteed sick leave. It's unpaid at that point, but they still do have access to sick leave, and I just wanted to make sure that was on the record. I feel like there was some discussion about whether or not they would even get this benefit, and they still would have the benefit of sick leave. It's just whether or not that small business would be qualified for the paid or unpaid portion of the law. There was some talk about economics and what the economics look like for the families who are accessing the sick leave. I would argue that was part of the intent when Senate Bill 454 passed, and there was some discussion in the subcommittee on, I think it was Human Services, about the economics for family businesses. You heard from family farmers. I won't reiterate their testimony in the interest of time, but I do hear from the opponents that they have some concerns about how specifically that LLC provision would apply. And this is our bill. It was one that we had drafted kind of after going through rulemaking over the past 2 years and trying to find that compromise point and trying to get that clarity that our folks needed, because they just aren't sure whether or not their family businesses count for the paid or unpaid portions of the sick leave law. But we do believe that there might be, and I tried to work on this with legislative counsel, and there might be a solution there, maybe focused on looking at the managing members of an LLC, or trying to carve out which members of an LLC are actually the business owners. So if that's where the concern is, we're definitely happy to engage on that. The intent was never to sign up everybody for an LLC and then exempt the whole business from paying sick leave or for qualifying. But I appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and you have our testimony. I would just reiterate from the family businesses and from our family farmers' perspective, this isn't about taking away people's rights. It's about making sure that a business can survive from year to year. We've had several years of low commodity prices. My folks don't necessarily have the ability to deal with the financial strain, and they didn't think that they would have to, some of these businesses. And so it's just correcting an interpretation for us. So.
Before, yes, Senator Hansel.
Just want to make sure, I don't have your testimony in front of me, but you said in it you do reference legislative intent as it was working its way through. Well, maybe it hadn't been handed out yet. I'm sorry.
Well, and Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, I reference three places of legislative intent. In the testimony. The first was the Joint Subcommittee on Human Services work on the final version of the bill and on final passage of the amendment, and they specifically discussed whether or not family members were to be included in the employee count. And in that discussion, they agreed, and the advocates and the legislative committee members agreed that they were not included under the language of that amendment. And there's a reference there and a link to the testimony. Similarly, in Senator Dembrough's summary of the final amendment, it includes a reference to that exemption. And then upon passage on the House side, Representative Paul Holvey, who was the co-carrier of the bill, stated, if a family member is working for another family member, are they covered under this bill? And that they are not. That's explicit in the bill. There is no confusion about that. So we aren't trying to open up a loophole. That was not the intent, and we're happy to come to the table to close any loopholes that folks see in this bill, but just trying to get back to where we believe that we were when this bill passed in 2015.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's go ahead and why don't you go ahead, sir? Thank you, state your name, please. Okay.
My name is Terry Cowart. It's the art of cows.
All right, thank you. We need a little humor around here. Thank you, all right.
I wanted to be an art, I didn't want to be a wart. So I thought I'd jump that right out there right quick. So my name is Terry Cowart. My family owns and operates Lebanon Auction Yard in Lebanon, Oregon, which is an S corporation. We're a livestock auction selling between 15 and 20,000 cattle annually at our Lebanon, Oregon location. We run a dealer business and sell country direct cattle to major feedlots in Oregon and Washington. Please bear with me. We run a livestock transportation company hauling cattle to and from Oregon, Washington, California, and Idaho. Our employee wages and compensation for 2016 was $225,000. 19 total employees, of which 7 are direct family members. Of the 19, 5 are full-time, working 40-plus hours a week. 3 of those are direct family members. Of the 19, 2 are part-time and work 32 hours a week. Of the 19, 12 are part-time and work between 3 and 10 hours a week, which 4 are direct family members. Of the 5 full-time, 3 work part-time out of the state of Oregon. The number of employees varies due to the head count of livestock we sell each week. A small weather-related auction might be 200 head of cattle, and a large fall-time auction might be as many as 800. We're just like a factory and an assembly line that it takes X number of employees to finish your job. When someone takes a day off, you have to hire a new employee for that day. Most of the part-time labor will be college students from Oregon State University or Lynn Benton Community College, as these employees will change as their class schedules change. Some students will split a shift. Somebody comes and works 3 hours in the morning. Somebody might work 3 hours in the afternoon due to class schedule.
Okay.
I promise.
Exit. Where do you live, sir?
Lebanon, Oregon.
Lebanon, really close, nice.
Where do you live?
Portland, Southeast Portland.
I could have told. No, that wasn't bad that way. Most of you guys are from Portland. I didn't mean that
I'm
bad.
From Port Allen.
I know.
I'm from Port Allen.
Oh, you just insulted that. He's from Athena. He's from Athena. It's the fancy red tie, Bill. You look like a city slicker over there. You know?
You guys are just tough on us. Us poor little country boys don't come to town.
Oh, see, Senator Hansel, they don't even know you're a farm boy anymore.
I know.
You've been here too long. Okay. I know, we know it's been on. We've tried to be well-behaved, but our person testifier from Lebanon, you know, so, but we realized, Debbie, that we cannot live without you. We're so glad you've returned. So we will resume. No gaveling needed. We will just continue on. And why don't you, we do have to be sensitive to time, though, especially now. So
okay.
We're going to have to move along here. So
forgot even where I was here.
Okay.
We do this. We allow these students to split shifts and things, do the and hire them because their livestock experience allows them to gain off-the-ranch business experiences. Employee turnover varies, some working a semester and some have worked as many as 30 years. One of our biggest problems with the new sick leave law was the lack of information flowing from the Bureau of Labor and Industry, our accountants, and our attorneys. It was a legal nightmare on how to implement. Our business had a current earned sick leave policy, which in my opinion was better than the one we have today. We paid 0.02 for part-time employees and 0.04 per hour for full-time employees. I actually had an employee quit, a longtime employee quit, over the law because we gave her 2 weeks. When we implemented the new law, she thought she would get 3 weeks because she now had sick leave rather than earned leave. This has been an accounting nightmare, and it looks to me like it could have been a little easier and implemented maybe if we just went off by a company's gross annual wage. We wouldn't be arguing over who was an employee or who was family and who was not. I mean, obviously, from the previous testimony, we have some discussion on what may be an employee, what may be a family member. So this whole deal here, I appreciate your time. I appreciate the fact that you know that there's some issues here, and you're opening this up to the possibility of correcting some of them.
Okay, thank you, sir. Sir, there was someone
I was
else
willing to answer
in your
questions.
Chair Taylor, thanks for the opportunity to testify. I'm Jim Geisinger with Associated Oregon Loggers. You know, in the interest of time, I'd like to associate myself and our association with Ms. Dressler's comments. They were right on. They reflect our concerns almost to a T. Our association represents over 1,000 small family-owned businesses involved in the contract logging business. Mm-hmm. Just by coincidence, our average member has between 8 and 12 employees, so this bill is very, very relevant to them. They're typically S corporations, they're partnerships, some are C corps, but they all have numerous family members that are involved in the ownership and the management of the company. And we believe the legislative intent of the original bill was not to include those people in the tally of how many employees they have for purposes of implementing the bill. We feel quite strongly about that, and I think Jenny did an excellent job of articulating our concerns. So in the interest of time, I'd like to leave it at that, and you can count on us to be in the same camp as the Farm Bureau.
Okay, thank you, sir. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, thank you for coming. And then I'm going to ask Iris Hodge, and is Emily McLean here? Oh, there she is. So please come forward.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Chair Taylor and members of the committee. My name is Iris Hodge. I'm with Main Street Alliance, for the record. We are in opposition of Senate Bill 779, and really there's been so much discussion from our folks about the details of the paid sick day law as it stands now. I don't want to go into that. We believe the details on what we believe are that BOLI, the definition that BOLI has set out is correct. There's been a lot of conversation about keeping things simple. And I think that the easiest way to keep things simple is to leave it is the way that it is, right? We've had this law for a year. Lots of people are benefiting from it. We are all small business owners that are in support of this, and they really value their employees. They're the biggest asset of a small business, right? So when this passed, our members were very excited, and they've had lots of employees benefit from this. And if we want to keep things simple, why change the law now? You know, there's been lots of argument about definition, and really we just want to make sure that this law continues to give coverage to all employees regardless.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. McLean.
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Emily McLean, and I'm here on behalf of the 44,000 members of the Oregon Education Association. And again, also in the interest of time, we will say that we do have concerns with Senate Bill 779 and want to register those with the committee. We, as an organization, were a part of the Fair Shot Coalition and the Everybody Benefits Coalition that worked hard in the 2015 legislative session to pass a strong and inclusive paid sick leave law for Oregon workers. We're still a proud member of the Fair Shot Coalition and do have concerns, and I've heard from both sides that there is a desire to have conversations around this legislation. And so I think that that's important, because the Oregon Education Association worries about rolling back the legislation, because educators know all too well children and workers going to work and school sick because they can't afford to do that. So I think it's important that we do dig into the concerns, and we hope that the committee will work with folks like Kate Newhall, who I think represented a lot of those concerns really well, and we'd be happy to be a part of those conversations too. But we just want to put on the record our concern for this legislation as it stands right now, and would really appreciate ongoing conversation before something were to move forward, because we're worried about rolling those benefits back. Okay. So thank you.
All right. Thank you both.
Okay. So I want to thank everybody for coming to talk today about Senate Bill 779. And there's a lot of discussion about legislative intent. And obviously, we're not moving any bill. I want to encourage folks from both sides to get together and to try to talk this out a little bit more, and with Boley to see if there can be some additional discussions to see if there can be some clarifying language about really what the bill is and what the sick leave original bill did. I think that we're not quite done here. I want to get some more information. So obviously we're not moving anything. So we'll just continue the conversation on. So we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 779 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 294, and ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
This bill is at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. It permits employee of state agencies or representative of state employees bargaining units to seek judicial review of a contracting agency's cost analysis in certain circumstances, establishes jurisdiction of judicial review. It requires a contracting agency to halt procurement while under review, except when a compelling interest or emergency is expressed in writing and supported by substantial evidence. It outlines judicial authority during review. It prohibits an award of costs or attorney's fees. It provides additional steps to the procurement process, and it creates an effective date of 91 days after signee die. There's no amendments before the committee today, but my understanding is that proponents will be talking about a conceptual amendment.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to go ahead and bring forward Tyler Shipman, Sarah Drescher, and Jared Mason-Gear, please. So, Tyler, why don't you start, please?
Yeah.
And then we'll have Sarah go over any of the details. And who's going to talk about the potential amendment? Okay, you are, and then we'll have Jared go. Okay, thank you. And then on deck, let's have Lori, Angie, and Brad Earl be ready to come up and speak after, please.
Right, so.
And we have another bill after this. The fire alarm kind of threw this all off here, and some other folks who have traveled for the other bill. So I, again, we're not moving anything today, but I need people to be a little sensitive. Thank you.
Absolutely. So, Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Tyler Shipman. I am a government relations specialist with the Oregon School Employees Association. Our association represents over 2,100 education employees across the state. I'm speaking today in support of Senate Bill 294, which addresses shortcomings in the current subcontracting law. And of course, in the effort of time, I'll try and be brief. So our members are extremely passionate about the issue of subcontracting. We're actually really fortunate enough to have our lobby day this last Monday. So some of you might have actually been able to meet with our members and hear some of their stories as it relates to this. I know when I talk to our members, the one thing that they always try to make clear is that they have a legitimate fear of being subcontracted. I think this fear is well-founded. We know that when our members' jobs are outsourced to a private company, they see a reduction in their salary, health care, and retirement benefits. Salary can be reduced by paying time for training at minimum wage instead of at the actual driver rate, or by reducing their hours. Healthcare may be offered, but the company often requires that the employee pay the entire premium. Of course, many of our workers, or many of our members, are low-wage workers, and they can't afford that. Once staff is subcontracted, also, they are no longer eligible to receive PERS benefits. While the private employer may offer a pension plan, usually there's no employer contribution to that plan. In rural areas, this is also extremely difficult for our members, because when they are subcontracted out, there usually are no other options for taking different types of jobs or anything that might fit into their field. In these areas especially, the money that they make goes right back into the community. So by receiving a lower wage, this also reflects the community around them. Our members work in education because they want to work every day to actually support staff and students in creating a positive educational environment. The private companies that these jobs are outsourced to have only one real goal, and that is to make profit. So this is a serious issue for us. Luckily for me, legislation recognized the significance of this and already passed legislation in 2009 that required a cost-benefit analysis be performed before procurement for services. When the contract price is more than $250,000. The goal of this legislation was to ensure that there were real cost savings and that those cost savings were not on the backs of employees and their wages and benefits. Since the passing of this cost-benefit analysis, we've really seen that there are several problems with how it's been implemented. Senate Bill 294 aims to address these issues to ensure that the law accomplishes actual original intent. So as you heard, we do have an amendment coming to this bill. What I was going to do is briefly go over the bill and then address the concepts of the amendments, if that's all right. Or do you want me to just do the amendments?
Yeah, just real quick.
All right, we can roll into that if you'd like.
Yeah.
All right. Also with me here is Sarah Drescher. She is a partner with Tedesco Law Group. She's also our legal counsel for OSCA, and she's definitely here to, I guess, answer your more complex questions. So the amendments that are coming forward are to address concerns that were raised by various stakeholders. The first thing that we really want to do is narrow the scope of the legislation. This is in Section 2. We're looking to have this only apply to schools. The second part that's coming through is that the review of RIT process, which is the current process that these challenges would go to, it would be changed that it would be going to an arbitration process. OSBA had raised a strong concern about the fact that this stuff was going to the courts, especially because of the length of the time and the potential cost of lawyers and representation. We wanted to recognize this concern. Sarah will speak a little bit more to this, but the process is faster and also usually cheaper. Additionally, in Section 4, we're going to remove the provision that would include foreseeable fluctuations in costs to be included in the miscellaneous costs. In Section 4 also, we want to remove the provision that requires a subcontractor profits be provided to the district. Stakeholders had raised some serious concerns about this provision. Right now it's unclear if profit is required or not, but in a good faith effort, we were willing to remove the term to keep the law ambiguous. Finally, we wanted to remove the provision that prevents a district from including proceeds or revenues from selling or costs incurred for replacing any of this contracting agency's long-term assets. So that's a brief overview of the changes that are going to be coming. I think it's really important to note out of all of these changes that each one of these that are being brought forward in the amendment is a concession. In the past, we have really taken an all or nothing approach without really any success. This time we listened to the concerns of other involved parties in an effort to actually move this legislation forward. What I'd really like to state too is that this legislation is not intended, nor does it prevent districts from making the decision to actually subcontract out. This legislation is to provide employees with a process to challenge a cost analysis when it is not completed correctly as required by statute. This is a real issue for all school employees. They deserve the ability to challenge an unfair cost analysis because it affects not only the quality of their life, but also their community and the services that schools provide. As such, I urge you to support this.
Okay,
and
thank
you. And I'll turn it over.
So, Sarah, you're the attorney for there. Do you have anything you need to add, or can I have Jared? Is there anything that he didn't state that you feel you need to add up for OSEA?
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, I will try to be very brief.
Okay, perfect. Just state your name, please.
Things. My name is Sarah Drescher. I am a partner with Tedesco Law Group. We're a labor law firm. We represent unions across the state of Oregon, and our public education sector clients include the Oregon School Employees Association, also the American Federation of Teachers, and the United Academics at the University of Oregon. As Tyler mentioned, the cost analysis has a purpose, and the purpose is for transparency. If we are using public taxpayer dollars and funneling them through a school district to pay a private contractor to provide our school services, transportation, the food service employees, custodial, we have a right to know where that money is going. And the purpose is to show through the cost analysis that it is a true cost savings to the taxpayers of Oregon, and also that the cost savings are not solely achieved by slashing wages and benefits and turning family wage jobs in our communities to minimum wage jobs. Now, the law is great in theory, but the problem I have experienced is that there is no legal process for resolving a school district's failure to comply with the cost analysis. There's nothing in this law currently. And as a result, there is no way for employees or their unions to challenge an unlawful cost analysis that doesn't show cost savings or that shows cost savings by slashing those wages and benefits. I experienced this firsthand. I've had the only case that has taken this all the way to the Supreme Court. And I will tell you, representing a bus driver who challenged her school district's cost analysis without anything in the law telling us what the process should be took 4.5 years. 4.5 years start to finish. Now, my bus driver ultimately prevailed. The district did not comply with the cost analysis provisions. However, by the time the decision came around, my bus driver had lost her job. She had struggled to find work in rural Southern Oregon. The school district had sold its entire fleet of buses to this private corporation, could not get them back. And every bus driver previously employed by the school district had been laid off. You can't unring that bell. Even those bus drivers who found new employment with First Student suffered a nearly 50% loss in total compensation. The entire point of the original legislation was not met. And there was nothing we could do because the sheer length of the judicial process failed to provide equitable and justice relief here. And Senate Bill 294 and the forthcoming amendment would prevent that from happening again. It's going to provide a fast and cost-efficient arbitration process that would allow the parties to resolve these disputes. Arbitration, which is coming in the forthcoming amendment, is an alternative to the court process, and it's already used by labor unions and public employers in the state of Oregon. In fact, Oregon's Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act already provides arbitration as the preferred dispute resolution process. In other words, this legislature has already decided that the proper dispute resolution process is arbitration. It does not require attorneys. OSBA representatives often do arbitrations by themselves without an attorney, and union representatives can do it, so it's cost savings. There's no court fees, there's no motion fees. The only fee is paid to an arbitrator, and it's split between the parties. It's typically $1,200. In addition, it is faster. Unlike the court process, which took me 4.5 years, arbitration, I do them several a month, takes, you know, a month, 2 months, 3 months to resolve if you fast track it, longer, but certainly it's a matter of months, not a matter of years. I also want to finally close by saying you're going to hear certainly from the opponents, this is to prevent outsourcing. And let me be clear, if this goes through with the forthcoming amendment, if there is a challenge and it goes before an arbitrator, the arbitrator has a choice. And the choice is, did the district's cost analysis comply with the law? If it did not, the district has the opportunity to revise its cost analysis and try again. It does not prevent outsourcing. It ensures that the goals of the law are achieved. Because if we don't have a process for ensuring compliance, then the law is simply a goal without any mechanism for enforcement. Thank you. I'm open to any questions.
I just have a clarifying question. So in this bill, would the if there was a desire to outsource with a company, would that company be required to show its profits?
In the current, Chair Taylor, members of the committee, In the current version of Senate Bill 294, it does say they have to share profits. However, in the proposed amendment, we are removing that as a concession to concerns raised by opponents of the bill. And so in the amended version, the private contractor would not have to share its profits in the cost analysis.
Okay, since obviously you're extremely well-versed in this area, so how would you be able to prove then that they did not, as you said, slash wages in order to increase profit? How would you be able to prove that then?
Chair Taylor, the cost analysis still requires a very detailed and thorough a framework, and it's set forth in the statute showing all of the wages and benefits that will be paid to employees, all the cost savings in certain areas. So while it doesn't include the actual profit made by the employer, it should be revealed through the sources of expenditure.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jared Mason Gear, representing the Oregon Education Association, our 44,000 educators, including a range of education service professionals or classified employees. In the interest of time, I guess I'll largely ditto Mr. Shipman's comments. If I was a little smarter and thought I could do so credibly, I would also ditto Ms. Drescher's comments. I won't do that, though. But just a couple of points that I wanted to add that I think are important is this isn't just about the employees themselves. So everything that's been said about the risk and the fact that education service professionals are kind of on the front lines when it comes to layoffs and cuts, all true, but there's a real impact on students and on our certified teachers that we represent as well when you lose access to these talented, committed professionals who in most cases have been in these positions for a very long time and have the expertise that's needed to do these jobs. Students, parents, educators all count on having professional staff in each school building, and then there's increasing evidence that show that that privatization does have detrimental impacts. Increasingly, I think it's also been clear that privatization is the exception to the rule, not the rule. So in most cases, districts are opting to continue to work with their contracted employees because they know that those are where they're going to get the best benefit for their students and certified professionals. Some examples of the kinds of commitments that our ESP make: more than 77% of education service professionals or ESP live within their school district. On average, they've employed at their district more than 12 years. 82% plan to stay in their profession. 67% stay with their current jobs until they retire. 61% give money out of their own pockets, just like certified teachers do, to help students with things like classroom materials, field trips, and class projects. Education service professionals are the ones who often are kind of the ones that reach out to students who are troubled, catch a student on the hall, and check in with them about their day. They're the ones who are having this kind of person-to-person impact. So the work they do is vital, and it's really important that we're thinking through not just the cost implications when we're making these decisions, the sort of superficial cost implications, but thinking about what kind of impact this has all the way down the line. So we think that this bill is important because there's a lot of aspects to privatization that aren't able to be analyzed just on the kind of at the very superficial level. Everything else that Tyler's said, I think, is good analysis and important reason why the bill should pass, why the amendments are important. I want to make sure and have on the record some of the other aspects of these conversations as well. Okay. Thank you, so I urge your support.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you
all for coming. We're going to go ahead and call up Lori Satin-Spiel, and Angie Peterman and Brad Earl. I'm going to have to ask between Lori and Angie, two different organizations, I guess. So, okay, all right. I'm so sorry. So this other bill that we have other people who have traveled to come today, and I'm so sorry. The fire drill really threw us off. So we're not moving the bill today, so I will have to ask to be brief. Please, who would like to start?
Lori?
Okay.
Madam Chair, Lori Satin-Spiel for the Oregon School Boards and members of the committee. Here today in opposition to this bill. As Tyler,
I want to clarify before you get going, what I heard from the previous panel was that there was an amendment that I know the amendment's not ready, but are you aware of the amendment and the details of the amendment?
I heard that there was an amendment coming, haven't seen it.
Okay. They kind of went over it briefly. I realized that this is not traditionally how we handle things, but you heard some of the things they were referring to. You're in opposition, but you have you had the opportunity to really talk about the potential amendment to
we
see how you feel about it?
We, offline before this bill was scheduled, had been working with OSCA to say, let's talk about this in the interim, see what we can do with the cost analysis, because districts are also concerned about the way they have to arrive at the cost analysis and how can we make this law better.
Okay.
And we talked about how we could keep it out of court. Okay. I think the other thing that's missing here was we talked about fact-finding and some kind of a third-party person to review cost analysis.
Okay, so go ahead. I just wanted to understand about where
I do appreciate OSCA and us talking, and we're still trying to work on this, and we'd still like to take it into interim to have a thoughtful discussion.
Okay.
As was stated, Central Point down in down south was the first test case for this bill. And I kind of wanted to clarify, this was in court for 4.5 years. The district won at the lower level. It was appealed to the next level and then remanded back to the lower level, and then it was settled. So I just wanted to clear that up. So since the law has been in place in 2009, there's only been 9 districts that have contracted out. And as of this year, we've got a couple of smaller districts bringing buses back online, so people are bringing the service in back in-house. I want to take just a second to touch on a couple of your districts and how they handle their transportation in the essence of time. Senator Taylor, Lake Oswego has been brought up a lot.
I'm not Lake Oswego. That's okay. Southeast Portland. And Ann Leininger and I look alike. But that's
no. Got it. Lake Oswego is one that's been talked about for a while. And as you saw in OLIS, Mr. Lafer's All Costs Considered has had 3 versions of it. And there's some testimony in there. And it calls out Lake Oswego for how they handled their situation. They contracted out in 2003 before the 2009 law has ever been in place. It's been several years that they've been actively engaged in their third-party transportation process. And in speaking to their district, they would not look back. They've saved money throughout. Senator Gelser, in your district, as you know, Corvallis uses a third party. In talking with their district, because you've got a mixed model, and Corvallis does contract out, I asked about that, and they say, well, they do have some challenges with some of the special needs folks, and they do use the Benton County dial a bus occasionally and taxis and for special purposes.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just for clarification's sake, that is new. They have done that for some small pieces. We've had very significant problems with safety, including appropriately securing wheelchairs. And as a school board member, as we dealt with this, we had absolutely no authority to deal with those issues. We don't have enough school bus drivers because we can't get them, so we have ads in our newspaper and along the side of the road saying, please apply to drive our buses today, no experience necessary, which makes me not really excited about putting a 6-year-old on the bus. We can't go backwards because we sold all the buses before I was on the school board, but most school board members that I have talked to are not happy that we have contracted out our school buses in Corvallis. I think it's one of the biggest mistakes that the district has ever made. It hasn't worked well for kids. It's not been safe, and there really is no accountability. So just because you brought up Corvallis, I wanted to know.
So let's right now I need to so thank you, Senator Gelser. So let's try to focus on the bill, and you've started off by saying you're opposed to the bill. Can you please tell us what it is that you
local control?
Okay,
Senator.
Okay,
and that's where I was going with just explaining. Senator Hansel's district has a mixed delivery of smaller districts who use a third party vendor, budget, expertise, drivers, and Albany in Senator Gelser's district does do it in house. They still have challenges with hiring drivers, and that's statewide. And I know wages have gone up to get drivers. And again, it's a tool that each district needs to be allowed to use and continue to use. And I'm trying to go quickly here. Nancy Hungerford was going to be here. She represents some of the school districts. She had a couple of cases dealing with proceeds of sale, which is in the bill. And we have a couple of districts who had to go to the third party because they couldn't maintain their facilities, and so they use those proceeds to take care of some of those maintenance issues. Again, a local decision. I'll kind of stop there so Angie can talk, and then come Brad.
Okay, so Angie.
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, for the record, I am Angie Peterman. I am the executive director for the Oregon Association of School Business Officials. So we're all the finance and operational folks in districts. Thank you for the opportunity today. I will certainly try to move quickly through the information that I wanted to share. And as Lori indicated, you know, we're here in opposition, obviously, of this bill. I appreciate very much some of the amendments that were noted today. There are still some things that are significant issues from my perspective within the bill as it still stands, and certainly not having seen the written amendments, sure. There some of these may be incorporated, I don't know. But one thing is that there's a proposal to change the term solely to primarily as it relates to wages and benefits. So that if the primary reason under this revision for savings is related to savings on the wages and benefits side of things, we'd be prohibited from contracting out. When you consider that 80%+ of what we do is related to salary and benefits in K-12 education, I find it difficult to imagine that we could ever get beyond the primarily issue of wages and benefits, even if we can show savings in fuel costs, in capital costs, in any number of other issues. So that is of significant concern still to me at this time. The other issue has to do with the fact that the language proposes to exclude the cost of capital improvements. So our cost of acquiring buses would be excluded, even though when we look at the cost that we will incur from a contractor, certainly capital assets will be part of the cost that we bear from them. So, and I think that the other thing I want to point out is that currently in collective bargaining, there's already an opportunity for conversation and bargaining to occur between the district and the union if we're looking at contracting out. A contract could have language that says the district can't contract. It may have language that says they can, and it could certainly have language that says they can, and I have seen language that says they can, but only if the workforce is maintained by the contractor and wages and working conditions are comparable in that transition. So to add another layer, if you will, of consideration on the part of individual employees after having gone through all that process seems inappropriate.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Earle.
My name is Brad Earle. I'm the Chief Operations Officer for the Medford School District.
Thank you for coming all the way from Medford.
Yeah. Well, I'm here hopefully to just clear up some misinformation about having partnerships of this nature. Medford School District has had a couple decades worth of partnerships with First Student. Their prior name was Laidlaw. Backing up just a little bit, you know, it's Classified Workers Week, and we're celebrating that this week, and we made a video to celebrate Classified Workers Week. And it's interesting because we interviewed kids in the cafeteria to talk about who their favorite employees were at the Medford School District, classified employees, and they named bus drivers and cafeteria workers repeatedly. And it's funny because both of those groups work for different companies than our company, First Student and Sodexo, respectively. But we work hard, and I'm saddened to hear the story from Senator Gelser, because we work hard to have that, a partnership. We work with them very closely. I was up at 4 o'clock in the morning on Monday driving the roads, just like my counterparts at First Student, to make sure that it was going to be a safe day for our kids. It's what we do when there are all kinds of weird microclimates in Southern Oregon, and we don't give up those responsibilities to make sure that our kids are safe. So two decades of these partnerships with a group that's represented by Teamsters, so they're not an unrepresented group. We worked with them, in fact, recently to raise the beginning wage for drivers in the Medford area to $16 an hour, and work with them constantly throughout the year to make sure that we're creating an attractive position for people to have and have steady work in that area. People in my line of work, you know, have to make decisions every day about prioritizing, you know, the limited resources that we have and putting them where they're at the highest priority. I think that bills of this nature and the previous nature make it hard for me to do my job, because what I want to do is keep a quality teacher in the classroom in front of students. That's my number one priority. Unfortunately, they're usually the first to go when we struggle to make ends meet, especially with the rising cost of PERS. And it's unfortunate that these kinds of decisions have to be made, but due to the 2 or 3 decades of PERS increases that we're facing, my district just got a $2.8 million increase that we're looking at in the next biennium per year, and then another one on top of that. These are the realities that we're facing. Even if Measure 97 had passed, we would have still been looking at kind of eating that up in the first couple of years and then going back to tightening our belts in the next biennium. So we prioritize every day. This is my second career. I was a private sector guy prior to this. And I tell my people it's our job in support services to work ourselves out of a job every day. We need to make sure that we're putting our resources where they make the most difference, and that's in the front line.
So sorry, I'm
wrapping up.
Okay, great.
I promise
thanks.
You. I think also, we hired a new superintendent. We're starting to get some really great results. I think you've seen that our graduation rate went up 10 points in 1 year, and now we're starting to distance ourselves from the middle of the pack and getting some results. Part of that is that we're not distracted with things that are not in our primary mission, and these are things that are a distraction to school districts. It's disappointing to me that they spend as much time as they do on these kinds of things because we're able to focus on what matters. We have a saying down there, keeping the main thing the main thing.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I'm sorry for being so rushed. We have this other bill. So thank you for coming. I'm going to close the public hearing unless there's any questions. Thank you. We're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 294. We're not moving the bill. We'll have further discussions on this. And then we're going to, committee members, Senator Beyer is here. This is his bill on Senate Bill 780. Can everyone stay just a little bit longer, please? Thank you.
Since it's Lee, yes.
Okay, thank you, Senator Hansel. So we're going to open a hearing, and I want to be clear that I'm sorry everything was so rushed on the previous bill. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 780. And Deborah, can you summarize the bill, please?
Yes. SB 780 is sponsored by the Committee on Business and Transportation. It requires the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to conduct random selection of qualified physicians for independent medical examinations of injured workers. It authorizes the Director to adopt rules to establish a process for randomly selecting a physician and a process to select providers to perform IMEs outside of Oregon. There are no amendments at this time.
Okay, thank you. And so we're going to have Senator Beyer, who's here, and then I'm going to call up Sherry Sundstrom, please, if she's still here. Oh, thank you. And I'm sorry, you guys, come on up and be. Let's have Arthur Towers. I apologize, Ms. Sundstrom, from OTLA, come forward. And then next up, we'll have Sherry Sundstrom and Hasina.
Beyer.
And we'll talk about Betsy Earls and Nellie at that time. So, okay, Senator Beyer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record and members, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Senator from Senate District 6, which is the center part of Lane and Linn counties. You got this bill referred to on workers' compensation. It's something that my committee has been working on for a couple of sessions. Apparently, they decided to try a fresh committee this time. This is an issue that really has to do with both fairness and the perception of fairness. I would take you back to start with the workers' compensation when it was developed in the early last century. Hard to say that, but that's true, 1917, I think. And the deal was made at that period of time, and Oregon was one of the leaders that said, employers, if a worker got hurt, would fix the worker, take care of them, and in turn for that, the workers could not sue their employer over an injury. That's kind of the basis. That's the deal, if you will, that was cut early on, and it's lived a long time, and we've been arguing about it somewhat every session since then, I think. What I'm interested in particularly is when a worker goes to their attending physician, their family physician, and the physician says, this is what needs to be done to be taken care of, and the insurer challenges that and says, we want an independent review. The independent review, then what happens with that? How does that happen? Well, the perception in the worker community, the injured workers, what I hear about, and I don't want to say a lot, I hear it, I've heard it many times over the last few years, is they think the system is rigged against them. The perception, whether it's true or not, is that the insurance companies have a stable of doctors that they refer people to, and their primary business is providing independent reviews, which just happen to favor the insurance companies in settlement. That's the perception. I think, frankly, that there's some truth to that as well. So what I was trying to do, and am trying to do, is to correct both. If that is indeed the case, let's take care of that. And if indeed it's the perception, let's make that better as well. And so what I thought I would do is my background tends to be in, has been in business development activities, real estate. And if you're familiar with the appraisal system, one of the ways that that system has been changed over the years is if you're going to get an appraisal of a business, you get that supposedly independent perception of what the value is. You have to contact, you can't contact, you have to go through a third party who selects that appraiser, and then they make the appraisal. That makes sense to me as a model of what we could do here. And my idea, my concept was, well, we have a department who's expert in this, that actually they're the ones that certify whether you can be an independent physician or not for reviewing these cases. Let's let them select that party. Then when the report comes back, it's truly independent. There's no perception that it's different than that. Having put the bill together, actually we've referred this bill to the Management Labor Committee for, I think, like the last 4 years, and they've been tossing it around. And if you're familiar with how MLAC works, it's the general thing is they have to have a consensus before anything can move forward. And the past practice of the legislature since 1990 is we wouldn't generally consider anything unless MLAC agreed. Well, that's been both good and bad at different times. And this situation, they've been kicking it around, and they have a recommendation that comes partially way here, which says if the independent physician disagrees with the primary care physician and the primary care physician doesn't respond to that, then the worker has the right to get a second independent review. Well, that gets at it partway, but I think it could be easier. In my mind, thinking again from the injured worker, at the end of the day, they ought to feel that they've been treated fairly, and they should be treated fairly, and so we should have independence. So where I think, and I handed out, I'm rambling here a little bit, but I handed out, I asked the department for their suggestions, and I want to be clear what you have, and it pretty much says at the start, is not recommendations. They're just providing help on the ways to get there. I think there's probably some middle ground here, even further than I hadn't thought of before we introduced the bill. So I guess I would ask if you're favorably disposed to thinking about this, that you give me a chance to get an amendment to deal with that. One of the things I think that makes some sense would be there are certain conditions that have to be met for fairness to the worker that they can get to a physician in a timely place, and it's particularly troublesome when you get out in the rural areas. But the department could fairly easily, as they've suggested, come up off their qualified list with three names of physicians, and in my mind they could very easily pick up the three names and give them to the insurance company if they want to review and say, schedule any one of these three people, schedule the worker for a review there, and that would give you a perception of fairness. I think the same would be true the other way, is if they gave three names to the injured worker or their representative and said, schedule one with these, and at the end of the day you would have something that at least feels to the injured worker that they'd been had a fair review of their situation. And I think I actually think if we did something like that, it would further limit the litigation coming out of the system and frankly keep some costs down. So that's kind of the notion I'm getting. I think it's really important that people feel when they're – I mean, put yourself in a position that someone who's really been injured and may not ever be able to work again, that at least their health is adequately considered fairly, and it goes there. And I guess I would say that I think the system that we have now through some of the fixes have – tended to rig it against the worker. We've really chilled the situation where it's very hard to get an attorney, and Art will probably talk about this, because it's we've limited how much they can get off of it. I think some of that's very good. But we've also made it very tough to be in that business of practicing. On the side of primary care physicians, if you get hurt and go to your primary care physician, they're really not, most of them very familiar with dealing with the worker compensation system, and it's a lot of paperwork that they have to go through to do this, so they're not inclined to do that. And frankly, as Senator Mona Sanderson knows, you know, one of the changes in medical practices that we've seen happen over the years is most all doctors now work for somebody else. They're into practices where they've got a medical director, or not a medical director, but a business manager says you need to see five to six patients an hour, and so their inclination to spend a lot of time on these is, you know, it's not great, quite frankly. While they do get paid to consider these cases, a lot of them don't know that. I mean, there is an education factor there, and frankly, you know, it's not in their business interest. I won't say it's in their personal interest, professional interest, but it's not in their business interest to spend a lot of time with these. So I think there's a balancing act here that's, you know, we try to keep the scales even. I think it's tilted right now.
Okay.
So that's essentially my point, and you can see what the department felt about it.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Beyer. Mr. Towers.
Hello. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. A number of our members fight for injured workers to make sure they get the medical care they need and get back on the job and get their lost wages. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and we support the legislation for many of the reasons that Senator Beyer laid out. The perception of the system being unfair for workers in this area can be addressed, I think, by the changes that are contemplated by Senate Bill 780. So we are in support. We are, right now, our sense is that the stable of physicians doing independent medical exams, again, for the reasons that you mentioned, do tend, at the current time, do tend to be share a philosophy with the insurance industry. So at this juncture, we're not... We don't support right now the change on line page 2, line 24, that has the worker request of medical exams being chosen the same way. But we think that eventually that we can get there once the stable changes over time. My theory is that as the process has changed so that doctors are compensated and selected at random instead of at the insurance company's choosing, that you'll have a more balanced stable of physicians to pick from, and then the random selection for workers becomes fairer, I would say. And the last caution that we have about the bill is as the department makes rules around out-of-state IMEs, we want to be very careful about that, because having the opportunity to cross-examine the doctor face-to-face is a very important part of the process, or can be. And so having an influx of out-of-state independent medical examiners could pose a challenge. So we just want to get that on the record, and happy to answer questions.
Okay. Thank
Madam
you.
Madam Chair, if I could add here.
Yes, Senator Beyer.
I think one of the perspectives that I've heard, and I respect it from the industry, is there's sort of the view is, well, the worker gets to select their family physician to do the initial report, so we ought to be able to choose the independent reviewer that we want. And that sort of implies a challenging position. But keep in mind in that dispute, while if they get to make, the insurer gets to make the determination whether the claim is legitimate or not. It's stacked pretty heavily on that side. There is an appeal process, but that's a very litigious process to do that. I think that what I'm suggesting here will have a tendency to cut back on that, because there's a sense of fairness. And if it does get into a litigious process. In fairness to the injured worker, frankly, what you're getting is on the selected, on the insurer selected side, is a qualified professional, an expert, if you will. Well, at least the worker ought to have a chance to have that too.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate it. I'm so sorry. We need to, in the interest of time, we have someone who's traveled here today to testify in opposition, so I want to make certain to.
Thank you.
Thank you. And so I'm going to call up Sherry Sundstrom and Hasina Squires. And so between Hasina and Dan, is there one of you? Oh, you'll speak. Okay, great. So thank you, and thank you for coming. And I'm sorry. We really, generally, things do not go this way, but I can't quit.
Good afternoon, Senator Taylor, Chair Taylor, and members of the committee. I am from Southeast Portland, just to make a point there. I, for the record, I am Sherry Sundstrom with Hoffman Construction, and I take care of the injured workers for Hoffman Construction, for our subsidiary companies, and in many, many cases, for our subcontractors across the nation. And so I'm very familiar and very passionate about this subject. I also sat on the MLAC for almost 12 years and participated in many discussions over the years for specifically two IMEs. But for today, I have provided written testimony, but in listening to the prior comments, I wanted to kind of bring this down to the level of the injured worker. I really, instead of carriers and perception, we really want to make sure that workers get returned to work, they heal, and they get to work. So part of the goal is to ensure that they are getting medical care that is quality, and then it really is addressing their injuries. And I have to tell you, in the construction industry, we have some significant losses. And so some of these injuries are very complicated. They're complicated because of the jurisdictions that we may be in. In my career, and that is 25 years spanning almost every state in the nation, I believe Oregon has the fairest workers' compensation system, and it's built on collaboration between labor and management. And there has been this notion of this perception issue with IMEs since I began on MLAC in the year 2000. So, you know, it's really important to take into account that I understand perception is somebody else's reality, but my reality with my injured workers on my job site is, if we cannot get answers as to what is going on with that injury, and it's the difference between a worker going out forever on a career-ending injury or figuring out what can be done and getting those workers well, let's move heaven and earth to have that happen. And that's what we make sure that our insurers are using IMEs for. I understand that there's some culprits out there that may be having some nefarious ideas of how to deny claims, but I got to tell you, from an employer that has over $1 billion worth of work going on at any given time, that our workers are an asset to us, very, very important. And you know, with all due respect, I have to oppose Senate Bill 780. However, there were some, I sat in on some of the subcommittee meetings for MLAC this summer, specific to IMEs, and there were a couple of really good suggestions that came up that would go back to the original worker-requested medical examination and make that broader and perhaps help workers that may have that perception that, that somehow the system is rigged. I don't think the system is rigged, and I really want to make sure that we're thinking about ultimately what these independent medical evaluations do. And as I sum it up, I don't know how the department has the time or the expertise to go through a worker. There's no two workers that are the same. There are no two injuries that are the same, and there are no two providers that are the same that can provide the quality of care, quality of recommendations for every single worker. It's not a blanket fix, at least not for Hoffman Construction and for all of our workers and our subcontractors on our job site. So thank you for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you, and you're a patient soul to sit through all these other bills, so thank you for doing that. Ms. Square.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hasina Squires, and I'm here today on behalf of the Independent Medical Examination Association. I visited with all of you individually prior to this committee meeting, except for Senator Gelson. The first thing I'd like to do is apologize. I represented to this committee that I wouldn't have expected to see the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association come in and oppose this bill. We participated in six actual subcommittee meetings at MLAC, and at no time did the Trial Lawyers Association indicate that they were supportive of a bill that would require random selection of IMEs. So I was surprised to hear Mr. Towers testify to that effect today, so I apologize for saying that I did not believe that the trial lawyers would be supporting the bill. With that, I do represent five member facilities, and so we are, as Senator Beyer explained, he would like a third-party selection process. Our facilities provide, I guess, a third-party selection because insurers contract with our medical facilities. Our facilities who select, who have stables, I guess, of physicians who are willing to conduct IMEs, and we select the physicians for the insurers that are appropriate for the injured worker. So there is a buffer that currently does exist in place when insurers do actually go through an IME facility, and there are five that currently belong to our association, and there are two more in the state that operate. So there is a buffer that is in place. I do understand, Senator Beyer, we've had this issue for a couple of sessions, and I do understand, Senator Beyer, and some other stakeholders' perceptions that there is bias in the system. What I can say about that bias is we don't see that in reported surveys. So the department sends out surveys injured workers about their experiences with an IME. I can tell you that for the five facilities that I represent, once an injured worker has concluded their exam with the physician, they're handed a survey and asked to complete it before they leave the office. We feel that provides them with the opportunity to complain. Did the doctor spend enough time with you? Was he courteous? Did he examine you? Did he hurt you? Do you feel like all of your needs were met? And I can tell you that if you look at the exhibit that DCBS submitted, our results mirror their results as far as the number of complaints that people are providing. And there are about 9,000 IMEs in 2015, and 23 complaints were registered with DCBS. That pretty much matches, ours are actually half of that, but that pretty much matches what we're seeing. So we're talking about less than 1% of people complaining about independent medical exams. And I can just say again, from our association's perspective, we're not sending the survey out at a time other than right after they've had the exam. It's concluded, it's completed, it's done, they've just experienced it, and we don't see any significant complaint about bias from the injured worker. We're committed to we believe that random selection doesn't provide for good quality care. Our job is, again, as Sherry said, to get injured workers back to work, and that's what we want to do. Not all 700 medical providers on the workers' compensation list are equal. Different claims take different kinds of doctors. We believe there's some sort of a self-selection process that also exists in good physicians who write quality reports, who aren't challenged legally by either side. If you write a good report and you're thorough, you'll be hired. Not because you'd write what the insurance company wants you to write, but because you are writing a defensible report that is of quality and that takes into account all of the factors, including the attending physician's information. So we're not seeing why a random selection process would be beneficial either to insurers or injured workers. With respect to the WRMI, which is our acronym for it, our nerdy workers' comp people, injured workers are already afforded that opportunity to use worker-requested medical exams. And I'll just ask you to just take a look at the information that DCBS submitted about worker-requested medical exams, maybe 100 a year. Workers are allowed, under certain circumstances, to ask for those exams. They don't, because they're represented. Typically, they have legal representation, and nobody wants to roll the dice and submit to a WRMI and get a randomly selected physician. The injured worker wants to select that physician, just like the insurer would like to select that physician. So while I understand what Senator Beyer is attempting to get at, we don't think this bill accomplishes that. Bias perceptions are always going to be there, but we just don't think that they're legitimate enough to actually pass legislation that randomly selects physicians from a list.
Okay, all right. Okay, does anybody have any questions?
Do we have any more people testify? No. I would, since DCBS has been brought into the, I was wondering if I could indulge them. I see Mr. Savage is back there. If I could ask a question about the work of the committee.
Sure, of course.
For the record.
And while he's coming up, Senator Gelser and Senator Hansel, while you were a tad bit tardy and I'm keeping you late, we did vote on Senate Bill 298, and at the end, I want to give you an opportunity to vote
on
that bill. Okay, at the end. So, yes. Why don't you state your name?
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, Lou Savage. I'm the administrator for the Workers' Comp Division.
Okay, Senator Hansel.
We have heard that it had been kicked back to a committee under MLAC, and I was just wondering, and they had recommendations they committed. I would be interested in a summary or your opinion of the work of the committee, what they did and what their findings were.
Chair Taylor, Senator Hansel, so the committee, the subcommittee of MLAC worked for a long time on the issue. I had a number of committee meetings. The conclusions are in that report. I think the substantive recommendation that a number of the witnesses mentioned was directed at the WRMA. The notion that it may be difficult under the current law for a worker to get their own medical exam, the worker requested medical exam. So the recommendation was to change the statute to allow that to happen more often. And it really the focus of that was when the worker was able to request that exam. The current state of the law requires that the attending physician affirmatively object to or not object but disagree with the IME. What the recommendation was from the MLAC subcommittee was to change the law so that if the attending physician did not respond at all, either positive or negative, it would still allow the worker, the worker's attorney, to request a medical exam.
Did the full MLAC, I assume as the subcommittee came back to the full MLAC, did the full MLAC come up with any recommendations? Did they forward that? What was there?
The full committee adopted that recommendation.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming up. I'm going to go ahead and it sounds like maybe Senator Beyer, do you think maybe it would be a good idea to, we can talk a little bit later, but to have it, do you want to have an additional conversation with folks about, you mentioned a potential amendment, a reference, did you? Yeah, no, I know, but I'm saying that we can go ahead and look into that a little bit more. So we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 780, and then we're going to give Senator Hansel and Senator Gelser the opportunity to vote on Senate Bill 298. So I'm going to reopen a work session on Senate Bill 298 for purpose of recording the vote of the members who were excused. So,
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow Senator Hansel and I to cast votes on Senate Bill 298.
Okay. Representative Gelser and Senator Gelser and Senator Hansel request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow them to be recorded as voting
aye.
Aye on the motion of Senate Bill 298. To the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 298.
Did we actually vote or did we just suspend the rules to let us vote?
I think it's all in one.
Oh, okay.
Requires, there we go. all right. So we are set there. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to, our next meeting is on Monday, March 13th. We will have an informational meeting with the PERS technical experts to answer the questions about the PERS proposals from the public. So you will be getting a document over the weekend, I assume, and it's going to lay out all the ideas. This could be our only time when no one's in the room when we talk about PERS. This could be the one and only moment.
Marcia's still here.
I don't know. And so, as you know, the public has submitted their own concepts of PERS reform concepts, including the Oregon Business Council, Association of Counties, et cetera. And so Deborah has taken those ideas, put them in a kind of grouped them, because some of them are the same ideas. And we will have the technical experts here, and we will go through the concepts and have a discussion about whether or not we think they're a good idea and if we want to take additional steps. So that's what's going to be happening on Monday, more PERS.
Sounds great.
So I adjourn the meeting on the Senate Work Committee on Workforce. And I want to say personally, everyone, thank you so much.